Hello, hello, hello. Hola, everyone. I am Jose Andres, and on this podcast, you know, I get to chat with very great people. People that sometimes I'm a fanboy in the distance, and sometimes I'm able to call them friends. This is the person I have today in the podcast, and I'm blown away by her. So get ready to say hi to the only, the one, Jane Goodall. And we all know Jane because she changed the way we see the natural world, right? I mean, come on. Just this woman alone in the middle of the forest. Yes, with her mom next to her, because if not, they will not let her go. Yeah, you're going to be fascinated. And we're lucky even she's going to be speaking chimpanzee to us. And yes, 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 we're going to be cooking, because I cannot spend 1 hour without cooking. And today, I'm going to show you how to make a great holiday recipe. You can be celebrating Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or like me, Christmas. This recipe is going to be great across religions. And my friends, today, yes, I will answer again any dilemmas or questions you may have. Stay tuned. So, Jane, welcome to Longer Tables.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm very excited.
It's a thrill to have you here. But every time I've seen you, I always see that you have a little friend next to you.
Yeah.
That is always next to you.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about him?
Yeah. His name is Mr. H. He's named after a man called Gary Horn, who went totally blind at 21 in the U.S. Marines, decided to become a magician. People said, but Gary, you can't be a magician if you're blind. The children don't know he's blind. And at the end, he'll tell them and say, things may go wrong in your life, but if they do, don't give up. There's always a way forward. He goes skydiving. He taught himself to paint. He thought he was giving me a stuffed chimpanzee 29 years ago for my birthday. And I made him hold the tail. I said, Gary, chimps don't have tails. He said, never mind. Take him where you go, and you know I'm with you in spirit. So he's been to 61 countries with me.
So here we love to talk in Longer Tables about food. Just tell me how you grow up eating in the post-war Britain. Was your mama cook? I mean, for what I know, you still live in the house where your grandma born. I mean, you born in the house. Do you have memories of food in the kitchen in your early days?
I have very, very fond memories. But before I went to live in the house where you're talking about, I stayed with my other grandmother, my paternal grandmother, and she had an old farmhouse. And what I remember there is the cook was making butter balls with these two pieces of wood and rolling the butter so that it had a little spotty pattern on it. I remember that so well. And collecting the hen's eggs so that we could eat them.
You will go to collect the eggs?
I went to collect the eggs. So the hens, mind you, were free. They were running around the way hens should. But they went into these little hen houses with nest boxes. And I was asking everybody, where is the hole on the hen big enough for that egg to come out? Because I couldn't see one. And they never told me. So I saw a hen going into a hen house. And I went and saw how a hen lays an egg.
You began finding in the very early years of your life the answers on your own.
Yeah, I was four. Then from there, we moved to the house you're talking about. And that was at the beginning of the war. So I lived through wartime Britain, when every food was rationed, when, you know, there was only like a very tiny joint, which we had on Sunday, and then anything left over was made into mince. And we had, I think it was 2 squares of chocolate a week. I mean, it was unbelievable, the rationing, 2 eggs a week per person, that was it. And luckily, we got food parcels from the colonies. Ours came from Australia because there were children in the house. And it contained dried milk and dried egg powder. So I grew up on dried egg powder. and hated eggs after that because so often they were runny and it made me feel sick because I wasn't used to that. You know, the little squiggly cords and oh my goodness. But my mother taught me if you go to stay with somebody, you must be polite and eat the food they give you. So how many times I nearly died.
What dishes you remember, if any, cooked with those ingredients? Anything that comes to mind?
Well, just about everything, but my grandmother was the cook. My mother used to burn everything, so she was no good. But my grandmother was quite a good cook, and she managed to use these strange ingredients. She occasionally made a cake, and the one time she made a cake that I remember best was a Christmas cake. And her beloved son, who was a surgeon, was there from London. He was treating the people harmed in the Blitz of London by the Germans. And she said proudly, I've put everything in this cake. She'd been saving up for like a month for ingredients, you know, a few raisins. And at that moment, her son bit on the cake and there was a piece of glass in it. So we never let her forget. You put everything in it, even glass.
I think eggs is a great way to start cooking. I think the first thing I ever cooked as a young boy was just a cake, a simple recipe.
Yes. But you know, growing up in the war, I'm really glad I did that. I learned to take nothing for granted. So if a piece of food spilled on the floor, you didn't leave it, you didn't throw it away. You didn't waste anything. That was a very good way to grow up.
My father and mother, very often when we didn't want to eat something, they will always tell me, well, we were young, and you know, post-Civil War Spain was not war, but post-Civil War Franco era, they will always give me the example that you eat everything. Yep. Like exactly the same story as you were telling me.
Yep.
And I think me, myself, made me to love and understand food better.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And you know, even when the war ended in Britain, we still had rationing, food rationing for at least a year, if not two, because, you know, there was so little money and soldiers were coming back and there was a lot of poverty and suffering.
So, you know, in Ukraine, they've seen people suffering because the horrors of war and because things like food that sometimes we take for granted.
Yeah, that's it. People today take it for granted. But you spend time in Ukraine, people there, some of them must have been so hungry.
Yeah, it's the power of food and the mayhem that war creates. So I want to know more about when you go and you arrive to Tanzania. You arrive, you are around 26. What was life like in the camp? What was the food like?
Well, life was me and my mother sharing an ex-army tent. And we had one cook because they told us, you know, you can't go, just you two women. Got to have somebody, and they found this cook to go with us. And he was a wonderful cook, and he'd worked for the different British administrators in the nearby town, one after the other. But they all fired him because he loved any kind of alcohol he could get hold of. So they said, well, this will be perfect. Jane and her mother won't have alcohol. They'll have a wonderful cook, and he won't be able to drink. Took him 2 weeks to find a really potent brew made of fermented bananas.
Fermented bananas?
Yes. It's more like a liqueur, I suppose. And it was very alcoholic. There was one very, very funny occasion when my mother left, and it was just before Christmas, so she was really worried. Jane's going to be on her own for Christmas. So she spent ages, she and the cook, Dominic, planning out how he would give me a nice Christmas dinner. So I was out all day in the mountains, and I came back, you know, thinking, oh, it's going to be this nice dinner. I mean, honestly, I don't care about food, but Mum had spent so long and she was so pleased. So I was thinking, you know, I'm going to be able to tell how wonderful it is. And I got back, there was a table laid, it was a little glass of flowers, which wasn't usually there. There was one plate, there was one tin of corned beef with an opener. That was it.
That's practical. It's like, if you're hungry, open the can.
That's right.
I like it. No food waste this way.
And he's drunk. Totally drunk.
Well, yeah.
But don't you love the touch of knowing that he was letting my mother down the little flowers on the table. It was just the funniest. I laughed and my mum was angry. But anyway, we had mostly tins, and the British told us that there was a village at the end of the national park, and they said, don't go there, it's full of really bad people. But I had met one African who was going to initially show me my way around the mountain, and it was his village, and he took us there. They were wonderful people. I don't know what was wrong with the British. They said it was full of witch doctors, and there were witch doctors for sure. But so we managed to get there, some fresh food, little tiny hen's eggs they have there, because, you know, they're all half wild. And we could
It's always eggs somewhere.
Yes, yes.
Dry, eggs. Fresh, it's always eggs somewhere.
But always hard eggs, not runny eggs.
So, in a film, you were eating baked beans
yes.
Out of the can. Do you like them? Still do that?
I don't really eat baked beans anymore. But I remember the scene in that film because my husband was filming and he kept getting it wrong. And so there was this tin of baked beans and on my plate was a fried egg. And he kept saying, we have to do it again. And so I was continually having to eat a spoonful of baked beans and cold egg. But
so you don't have good memories of that moment?
Not that moment, but, you know, we had good vegetables from the village. We had the tins. And so I didn't eat all day. I had a piece of toast. The cook made wonderful bread under a tin. It's very simple. And so in the morning, I would eat a little piece of that and coffee from a thermos. And then I didn't eat all day. And I came down and the cook had made very simple meals, you know, but what he could with a few tins, potatoes, cabbage, that sort of thing. But I have to tell you that it reminded me before I ever got to Gombe and the camp, it was when there was these riots in the Belgian Congo, as it was then, and the town where we arrived was full of Belgian refugees. And so we volunteered to be among the people helping to feed them. They were in a huge sort of, it was a place where the Belgians stored food when it came over the lake from on boats. And Mum and I were tasked every day with filling up tin trunks with Spam sandwiches. You remember Spam?
I love Spam.
Yes, I know, but that's all the poor refugees had. And very, very sweet tea that the Indians make with lots of milk and very little tea and lots of sugar.
So you were a humanitarian cook. You know, not very far from here, 50 meters, is where Mrs. Clara Barton had her offices.
Really?
And even everybody remembers her as the nurse she was and creating the Missing Soldiers Office and the American Red Cross. She also was part of, very often on feeding missions.
Yeah.
I see that you were already at very early age a food humanitarian.
That's right.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that about you. How many hours will you say in a day you will spend observing the chimpanzees?
Or searching.
In the distance, searching for them. I guess you spend no hours, but maybe days.
Weeks.
But then once you find weeks, and then when you will find them, these images of you being one with them.
No, it wasn't quite like that. But the first 4 months, and I only had money for six, the first 4 months, as soon as I got near them, they vanished into the undergrowth. And then one of them, and if I tell you, you remind me of him. I hope that doesn't insult you. I called him David Greybeard because he had a beautiful grey beard just like yours. He was my favorite chimp, and he was very, very handsome. So he began to let me get closer. And one day I saw him, he was sitting on a termite mound, you know, white ants, and he was picking pieces of grass. He would make a scratch open one of the passages, put the grass down, and pick off the termites with his lips. So he was using grass as a tool. And he was even picking a leafy twig and before he could use that as a tool, he had to pick off the leaves. And so he was making a tool. And at that time, it was thought by scientists that humans and only humans use and make tools. So that was the turning point. National Geographic came in, said they would continue funding when my 6 months ran out.
So when you see that he's using a tool to feed himself, you realize in that moment that what you were witnessing was life-changing.
Yes, and it was a it was the first time that I observed something which previously had been thought to be unique to humans. So it was the tool using. It was the fact that they have personalities. It used to be thought only humans had personalities, that they can solve problems, they're highly intelligent, and they have emotions, happiness, sadness, fear. But I don't know, do you have dogs?
No. Well, I have two, but they are robots.
Okay, well, I had a dog when I was growing up, and he taught me that animals have personalities, minds, and emotions. And so one by one, chimps proved that we are part of and not separate from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's just that we've evolved in a different direction.
Fascinating. Catching the ants and eating them raw, this in a way is cooking. So with this, I'm asking, then do the chimpanzees have a food culture?
Well,
like we do?
Yes, they do, because in different parts of Africa where they're studied, they have different food traditions, and they vary from place to place. And the tools they use, like in West Africa, they use rocks to hammer open hard-shelled nuts. We have the same nuts in Gombe, but they only eat the flesh and not the kernel. So there's many different food cultures. One group uses a long stick to scoop up algae from a pond, long green strings, a bit like spaghetti, and slurp it up. And there's all these different foods they eat. They eat them in one place, they're in the other, but they don't eat them.
Do chimps use foods as medicines?
They do, and they, interestingly, they use the same leaves or pieces of bark to cure, like if they get bad tummy, if they get worms. They use the same plant as the local people, which is really interesting.
And who learn from whom? The humans learn from the chimps, or the chimps learn from the humans?
I don't know. That's what we'll never know, will we?
Fascinating.
But in this area, there's a lot of, there used to be a lot of witch doctors, and many of them were medicinal healers, really. They were called witch doctors, but they were traditional healers, and they would prescribe this medicine.
So tell me, how is this moment? Because this had to be a fascinating moment. I cannot even imagine what was going inside you when you are accepted into that family. And you are there, living and eating with them. Well, what's that like?
Well, not really, because I would watch them all day if I could find them. I would then go back. And at first, of course, my mother was there. So the cook would have this food and we'd sleep in this tent. I never actually ate with the chimps. I didn't want to mess up their own lives, you know. So I would watch them eating, but I wouldn't be eating. There was a time when we fed them bananas, but I couldn't have eaten a banana with them because they would have rushed over and taken it away. You know, that early time when I really got to know them, they were almost like family. I knew them so well. Watching the infants observe their mothers, that's how they learn the tool using. And seeing how, you know, the mother is using a nice long twig to fish for termites. And the infant will watch her, then he'll try and grab her tool, which she doesn't like. She doesn't punish him, because he doesn't understand. She tickles him with one hand and goes on fishing with the other. And then he gets a very inappropriate little tiny tool like that. And of course, that doesn't do any good. But gradually, over the months, he gets better and better.
Going back, you are chosen to go study these chimps. Of the many other people that could be the chosen. You were persistent. You never took a no as an answer. And on paper, you didn't have the experience and or the training. And my question to you is, what's the lesson we all need to learn?
Well, I think the lesson is that I decided that I would go and live with animals and write books about them. I was 10 years old at that time, and I had the support of my mother. And I didn't go to university because we couldn't afford it. And so I got a boring old job in London and then got invited to Kenya by a friend. So I saved up money working as a waitress. And then when I got this letter, saved up money, I met this famous anthropologist, Louis Leakey, and he chose me for two reasons. And by the way, nobody'd studied chimps in the wild at that time, nobody. He chose me, one, because I was a woman and he felt that women might be more patient. Two, he loved it that I did not have a degree because he said, these scientists studying animals, they're so reductionist. And he wanted somebody whose mind was open and who was prepared to watch and learn from the chimpanzees. And it worked. It actually worked.
It worked amazingly well. You opened us to a world we didn't know existed. So, 1960s, talking about your food habits and love, you became a vegetarian. Tell me, what's this moment that you decide, I'm not going to be eating any more meat and or fish?
Meat and fish. Well, when I left England, there were no factory farms. You know, these terrible places where billions of animals are put in. It's like animal concentration camp. And I didn't know about those. And then I read a book by a man called Peter Singer. And it described the conditions in these factory farms.
Animal liberation.
Animal liberation. And so the next time, I was on a plane when I read this book, and I think it was a piece of meat that was on the plate. And when I looked at it, I thought, this symbolizes fear, pain, and death. And I didn't want to eat it. That was the last, I didn't eat it. I haven't eaten any meat since. Ate fish a little bit longer. And then, you know, realizing they feel pain too, I decided, no, I can't eat them. And then more recently, learning about the treatment of dairy cows and chickens in these places, I became a vegan, but I'm not a strict vegan. I can't be. I mean, when you're traveling around the world, you don't want to upset people who spend ages cooking for you. And I have my mother's early training. You never must be rude. You know, you eat what's put before you. But I sort of try. And during the pandemic, it was easy.
So I'm cooking for you later, and I have an entire vegetarian menu for you.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you.
We can have people that may say, but animals are carnivorous. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is this, that when it's subsistence, like, you know, you eat like you're living out in the wild, and also the way we used to eat, like I say, the chickens were running around in the farmyard, the cows and pigs were out in the fields. And it's this factory farming that's made the difference, the fact that these animals are so cruelly treated. And then when you learn more about the way this industrial agriculture is harming the land, because it's depending on chemical pesticides and herbicides, poisoning the land, affecting biodiversity, killing the soil. And then with the animals, huge areas to grow the grain to feed them. Did you know more grain is grown to feed animals than starving people? That was a shock to me. And then all these animals are producing methane gas, which is one of the bad greenhouse gases. I mean, we all produce it, you know, in our digestion. We hope not to do it in public, but...
We are using now grains too to produce fuels. So right now, the way we are using the land is not anymore to feed people, but as you said, also to feed the animals. So many people argue that's kind of a not very smart way to be feeding humanity. But now also the same farms of the same fields and the same grains are being used to produce fuel, putting, if anything, much more difficulty in for a lot of people cannot afford food because they're competing against the grain for animals and the grain for energy.
Yeah.
You're becoming a true vegetarian. I mean, this is, it's been activism for you. This has been part of who you are.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I tell you, once I became vegetarian, and other people have said the same, I felt so much lighter. And apparently, the carnivores, the animals who eat meat, they have a short gut because they want to get rid of the meat before it goes bad inside. Whereas the herbivores, the grazers, who eat grass and stuff, they have a long one because they want to get the last bit of goodness out of the food. And we've got the long gut. So in other words, this meat, that's why you feel that heavy feeling, or I used to, after eating a lot of meat.
I never thought about it. Amazing.
Well, isn't that amazing? As you, however long you live, you're still learning new things. I try and learn something new every day.
So you have a podcast that is called Hopecast.
Yeah.
And you published a book last year called The Book of Hope. You are a very hopeful person for what is to come.
Well, you know, hope depends how you think of hope. Some people just think it's wishful thinking. But to me, it's about action. So you agree, Jose, that we're living in pretty dark times right now. But I see us as a species, we're at the mouth of a very, very long, very dark tunnel. And right at the end, there's a star shining. That's hope. But we don't sit at the mouth of the tunnel and wonder when that star will come. No, we have to roll up our sleeves and we have to crawl under, climb over, work our way around all the obstacles that lie between us and the star. The good news is that the people working on every single problem, every one. But too often they work in their own narrow little tunnel and they're not thinking about the whole. So, oh, how wonderful, we've closed down this coal mine, not thinking that they've left people without jobs, who become poor, who destroy the environment in order to survive. So collaboration, cooperation, working together is so terribly important. But my reasons for hope, first of all, it's the young people, because they are more aware and they are taking action and they are not just thinking about the problems, they're solving them. So my second reason for hope is this intellect. We haven't used it wisely. Many people are not using their brains well, but we have the potential. And science is beginning to come up with, you know, renewable energy and things like that, finally. And then there's the resilience of nature. A place can be destroyed, and with time and some help, nature will come back and not be quite the same, but the wildlife will begin to come back and it can once again become beautiful. And then there's the indomitable spirit. The people who tackle problems that seem impossible and won't give up. And you know, Jose, you are one of those people because you tackle problems like when you go to Puerto Rico after the hurricane and now as you go to Ukraine. What you're doing seems to us impossible, that you can feed all these people, but you're doing it.
I'm not doing it.
You are organizing the
thing. We are doing it.
All right.
Somebody else is doing it.
Yes, but you started it.
So I've seen you speak sometimes, and I have to ask you to do this. You do a greeting on behalf of the chimpanzees. Can you do that for me, for us now?
Yes.
And then translate.
I will do a greeting to all of the people who are listening. Yes. Well, it goes like this. Translated, me, Jane. Hello.
Love it. Well, listen, I can be obviously here listening to you and learning from you for hours and hours and hours. But I'm so thrilled that you that you gave me the opportunity to have you here in this podcast. I love you. Longer tables.
I'm just as happy to be here with you, talking to you.
Before we head to the kitchen, a little reminder. Longer Tables isn't only a podcast. It's an online newsletter full of stories, recipes, and lots of conversation about how food shapes our world. Sign up at joseandres.substack.com. Okay, I was trying to start this segment, cooking with you in my kitchen, and I just burned a pot. I mean, I don't even know why the fire alarm didn't go in the building. What I'm trying to do, a red wine sauce. Why I'm doing a red wine sauce? Because what do we eat in Christmas? Desserts that they are always so heavy, so sugary, so much flour. And I'm showing you one dessert that actually is the contrary. It's a fruit, and it's very light. So you see, I've been boiling here the wine, and this is something you can do with all the white and red wine you have. And then you get sugar, and more or less you're going to be adding, I don't know, 200 grams, 5, 6, 7 ounces for every quart of wine, or 1 spoon for every cup of wine. Just whatever, just add and taste. If it's too sweet, add more wine. If it's not sweet enough, add more sugar. And now this is going to become a great reduction of red wine that is going to become a syrup because the sugar is going to melt. And you're going to be able to use it for a lot of different things. So take a look what you do. These oranges are unbelievable. You kind of make a cut very deep into the orange and another one in the bottom. And then you're going to go with a knife and you're going to go very deep. So you take all, not only the orange rind, but the white flesh, which is bitter, out of the orange. And then you keep going down with the knife, going in a curve around the orange. And at the end, you're going to have a perfectly peeled orange with none of the white bitter part, where literally this orange is getting naked. And once in a while, you look at the wine, so you make sure you don't burn the wine for a second time. And then look at what I have. So now this is pale. I told you the white is very bitter. I'm going to put the orange part of some of this peel of the orange against the cutting board. And I'm going to go down deep to take all the white flesh, almost all the white flesh. I'll do a second time because I think I didn't go deep enough. So you make sure that your hand is flat over the blade. You make sure that the knife is in between the orange rind, the orange zest, and your hand. And at the end, you have a perfect piece of orange peel without the white. And you're going to put this where? In the wine. And now the wine is happy because it's finally meeting something else beyond grapes. Is meeting oranges. Why? Because grapes and oranges don't grow together usually. And now the wine is like, hey, what's going on here? Wow, it's a party. Oh my God, you see how good this is? This is already done. Velvety. And this is the moment that you do something because red wine and cinnamon and orange go so well together. You're gonna add a little bit of the cinnamon. And now I have this, the oranges. And I'm gonna slice them. And I'm going to put them in the plate. And then I have something like it's super, super, super Christmas-like because the colors, not only the color of the ruby red wine, but pomegranates. My mom used to love pomegranates. And what you try to do, as you see, I'm not cutting through the pomegranate because if I'm cutting through the pomegranate, I'm breaking the tiny ruby seeds where the juices are going to be start flowing all over the place. So what I'm trying to do is really with the help of my hands to break the pomegranate. And the pomegranate is like a firecracker, loves to be opened up. Oh my God, this is overcooking already. Great, I didn't burn it. So take a look what we have, my friends. We have the orange. We have the best syrup in the history of mankind of wine. We're gonna put it right in the bottom. Take a look, the colors. The bright orange with the velvety ruby deep wine color. And just to finish, my friends, you come with the pomegranates, you put them on top of the oranges, and then, why not, you get some of these crystals of salt, Maldon Odor. And yes, don't worry, works, a touch of oil. And my friends, there you have an amazing dessert to finish any night during your Christmas, or actually for the rest of the year. If you have good oranges, this works. So if you want to see me making this amazing orange or red wine dessert for the holidays, hey, join me on my YouTube channel. Yeah, I have a YouTube channel. Oh, yeah. It's time to take some calls from our listeners. I haven't heard these questions ahead of time, so wish me luck, please. And if you have questions of your own, get in touch through the website, joseandres.substack.com.
Hi, Chef. My name is Young Tran, and I'm calling in from San Francisco, California. My question for you is, what is the most memorable meal that you've had in the past year? And what was it about the meal that made it stand out to you?
So thank you, my friend Young Tran. Listen, it's always very hard for me to decide what was the best meal or most memorable and what made it special. Because I don't want you to be jealous. I have so many of those moments. Well, because I'm always surrounded by friends that I cook for or friends that cook for me. But 2021, September, is a big earthquake that hits the southern part of Haiti. And there I'm going back to Haiti for another earthquake. This allowed me to go back to Port-au-Prince and to visit my good friends, where it's a house that every time I go to Haiti, I usually stay when I'm in the capital, Jean-Marc, the Matei, and his beautiful wife, Beren. And I'm always cooking with them. And Beren, she makes a dish called griot. Griot is like a national dish in Haiti. It's an amazing pork butt that is marinated with spices and orange juice and who knows what else, because I never seem to get the right recipe. And they marinate it, then they cut it in pieces and they fry it. And they will serve it simply fried like that with piglis, which is this kind of amazing Haitian coleslaw. What can I say? Griot with piglis is one dish that for me is just fascinating. For me, used to be in their house back in Haiti, feeling like we did a good job taking care of the people in need and celebrating again with friends and family in their home in Port-au-Prince. For me, probably was one of the most memorable dishes and moments of the last year. That's a wrap, people. Longer Tables is produced by Chris Collin, who also makes our music. Jane Black is our executive producer. Sasha Mandel is our audio engineer. And remember, if you like what you're hearing, I hope you'll come back for our next episode or sign up for my newsletter. Also call Longer Tables at joseandres.substack.com.